It's Tuesday, October 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, combating Islamic State in Syria as U.S. and Russian relations strain.
Who gets to control the territories that are going to be freed by the Islamic State?
Turkey's role as Iraq begins a push to liberate Mosul from Islamic State. Also ahead, a scathing human rights report for Australia. Financial markets watch corporate earnings, and we visit America's national parks. It's all on today's International Edition. The Turkish-backed Free Syrian Army took control of the northern Syrian town of Dunbeek from Islamic State, part of Ankara's operation to create what Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan envisioned would be a 5,000-square-kilometer safe zone. Meanwhile, the United States and Britain are considering additional sanctions against Syria and Russia for their assault on the rebel-held sectors of Aleppo. University of New South Wales Syria analyst Anthony Billingsley tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Islamic State group appears to be back on its heels in Syria.
Islamic State has never been a really significant player in the Syrian civil war. It's managed a few spectacular attacks around the place and that sort of thing, but its headquarters of Raqqa, the area that it has dominated, has been largely unpopulated. And to an extent, I think the Syrian government was happy just to say, well, okay, do what you like in there, but you're not really making much of an impact. The real players are the Al-Qaeda-linked groups and some of the other more extreme Islamist groups. So Islamic State is starting to suffer. The fact that they withdrew from Dabiq, despite Turkey's claims, I think they pulled out without too much resistance, unlike earlier conflicts on the border. I think they're just being tactical there. They're quite happy to pull out, and then maybe they'll come back again at a later date or whatever. They've shown considerable tactical flexibility in this conflict.
Anthony, on the diplomatic front, Britain and the U.S. Sunday said they're considering additional sanctions on Syria and Russia. Will that have any impact at all on the behavior of Syria and Russia?
Not on Syria. Syria is not dependent on Western goodwill anyway. There's not going to be sanctions from the Security Council, so that's not an issue. As far as Russia is concerned, well, we're really talking about a much bigger issue here, I think, aren't we, where we're talking about relations between the United States and Russia continuing to deteriorate. The sanctions on Russia from the U.S. and Western countries have been considerable. They've had, I think, real impact on the Russian economy. But the Russians seem to be accepting Putin's line that it's all a conspiracy and they need to fall in behind Putin. So we have to be, I think, very careful about just constantly ramping up the sanctions and remembering that Russia has other directions. It's got China that it can resort to, and you know, so it's not entirely dependent on the West.
Well, the West's hand then in Syria is pretty weak.
Look, I think it is. I think that really since the Russians intervened in a significant military way, they've really had the whip hand in the situation. You know, President Obama has quite, I think, plausibly decided he doesn't want to commit American forces in a significant way. And, of course, we've got to the point now where if there were to be an upgrading of the U.S. military involvement, there's the risk of some sort of collision with the Russians. So the Russians, I think, are sitting there reasonably comfortable as far as the Syrian conflict is concerned.
Meanwhile, EU foreign ministers meeting in Luxembourg are pushing for humanitarian aid to civilians trapped by fighting. It's time for us now to check out what's buzzing online. International Edition's social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, is here to do just that. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, we talk about another extremist group in Nigeria, but there's some great news coming out of there, right?
That's right. Boko Haram released 21 of nearly 300 girls the group kidnapped from Chibok last week, and the girls reunited from their families on Monday. Just to clarify, they were released last week, but they were kidnapped many months ago. The emotional reunion is captured on camera, and you can find it all over social media. CNN's Aisha Sasay is tweeting from the location, and here's an example. Just spoken to a Chibok mother whose girl wasn't freed. She has learned her daughter was married off and now has a child. #BringBackOurGirls. Sese describes herself as a child of Africa, and her handle is Aissa Sese, CNN.
Okay. Well, I believe she's from Sierra Leone, correct? Mm-hmm. So that
her
makes sense.
Her parents are, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What else is trending?
Jim, there are many serious and important topics trending on social media, but they don't compare to the popularity of the book and movie series Harry Potter. On Facebook alone, more than 260,000 people are talking about a new set of makeup brushes that look like magic wands. They are produced by U.S.-based company The Geeky Cauldron.
Well, what an apt name for a company that makes Harry Potter products. And I noticed on Twitter it's also hashtag National Pasta Day. Mm-hmm. What are people saying on Twitter?
A lot. Italian restaurants are, of course, jumping on the opportunity to promote their pasta promotions. Olive Garden, an American-style Italian restaurant chain, is one of them. It tweeted, "It's hashtag National Pasta Day, and you deserve the best. With hashtag never-ending pasta, you've got options. What will you choose?" I mean, if hashtag never-ending pasta is not the most American thing you've ever heard, I don't know what it would be. There were also talks about how carbohydrates have long been blamed for making people fat and how that could be wrong. Back to you, Jim.
Well, I know a lot of runners carbo load before big races and eat a lot of pasta, so maybe it isn't quite accurate. But thanks for that wrap-up, G, and you can follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE or our own individual accounts at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, Amnesty International slams Australia over asylum seeker camps. Pakistan says third Chinese-built nuclear reactor goes into operation. After threat of rift, Philippines looks to reset ties with China. Doctors hail China's pledge to stop harvesting inmate organs. Thai government moves to reassure roadmap to elections on target. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and also through our VOA mobile app on your smartphone. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. With Iraqi-led forces starting their operation to recapture the city of Mosul, diplomatic tensions have erupted again between Baghdad and Ankara over the operation. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul the Turkish president is demanding a role in efforts to retake the city and warning about the danger of ethnic cleansing.
As the military offensive to recapture Mosul from Islamic State militants began, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan launched a verbal salvo against Baghdad, demanding a role in the offensive.
Ne diyorlar? Türkiye Musul'a girmesin. Ya nasıl girmeyeyim? 350 kilometre sınırım.
He said, why Turkey should not enter Mosul. Turkey, he said, has a 350-kilometre border with Iraq, but others who have nothing to do with the region are entering the city. Ankara has a force of around 700 soldiers supported by dozens of tanks at the Başakşehir base close to Mosul. The force was ostensibly for training Sunni militia to fight IS. Baghdad has ruled out any Turkish role and called for the removal of the Turkish forces from Başakşehir, warning they could be targeted. Sunan Ulgen, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Europe in Brussels, says a dispute is about the nature of the forces involved in the Mosul offensive.
I still don't think that it's realistic to think that Turkish military will directly intervene in Mosul. It's more a matter of whether the different ethnic groups that are backed by Turkey will be the main force driving towards Mosul and capturing the city rather than the Baghdad-backed and the Iran-backed Shia militia.
Local media reports a Turkish foreign ministry delegation is to hold talks in Baghdad. Turkey's military chief, Hulusi Akar, met on Sunday with his US counterparts in Washington to discuss a Mosul operation and other issues. Ankara is already claiming success, saying 1,500 members of the Sunni forces it trained in Başakşehir will be in the forefront of efforts to liberate Mosul. the deputy head of the Ankara-based Turkish Asian Center for Strategic Studies, Murat Bilhan, says Turkey's chief concern is the risk of sectarian tensions.
The Shiite regime in Baghdad wants to cooperate with the Iranians to take over Mosul and to turn it into a Shiite stronghold. It is unacceptable for the original residents of Mosul, which will be just evicted and pushed towards north. Again, another flow of refugees to Turkey and so forth. This is unacceptable.
Aid agencies and the United Nations have warned that efforts to retake Mosul could result in hundreds of thousands of refugees. Turkey's already hosting nearly 3 million refugees from Iraq and Syria. Turkish government spokesman Numan Kurtulmuş says Ankara will ensure ethnic politics do not dominate Mosul. Ülgen says the prospect of an IS defeat is opening a growing power struggle.
Who gets to control the territories that are going to be freed by the Islamic State? And there is definitely a game of influence between Iran-backed members of the IS opposition, as opposed to Turkey-backed members of the opposition, the Kurdish Peshmerga, some of the Sunni Arab factions, and the Turkmen.
Turkish media report Iraqi Turkmen in the Mosul region are calling for autonomy. Observers warn as regional ethnic and sectarian rivalries grow, similar calls are also likely to grow. Erdogan has done little to allay Iraqi concerns, ruling out any withdrawal of Turkish forces from Iraq and declaring his country will play a role in any negotiation over Mosul's future. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Australia's treatment of asylum seekers amounts to torture under international law. That's according to a new report by the human rights group Amnesty International. About 1,200 asylum seekers have been forcibly transferred to what Australia calls an offshore processing center on the Pacific island of Nauru. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, Amnesty interviewed refugees and whistleblowers from companies contracted to run the asylum centers.
In strikingly direct terms, Amnesty International accuses Australia of deliberately inflicting suffering on refugees. Audrey Gogran is head of global issues at the organisation.
Essentially, they've chosen to treat women, men and children with unspeakable cruelty on Nauru as a way to implement a policy designed to stop boats arriving in Australia.
The group says many refugees have mental health problems, adding it has documented cases of self-harm and suicide.
It's an open prison and they can't leave. We've documented cases of physical assault, cases of sexual assault, cases of people who are ill but cannot appear to get the right kinds of treatment. Very harrowing cases where you see parents watching their children suffer and they can't do anything about it.
Even refugees who have successfully applied for asylum in Australia are being forced to stay on Nauru. Among them is Ellie, an Iranian human rights activist, who says via Skype she has been given refugee status.
My case got positive result and I'm a refugee now, but I'm still in Nauru. No third country, no Australia, no way. I'm still in the jail.
Australia says its tough policies are vital to halt people smuggling. Speaking last month at the UN General Assembly, Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull called his country the ultimate immigration nation.
Porous borders drain away public support for multiculturalism, for immigration, for aid to refugees. Most importantly, the only way to stop the scourge of people smuggling is to deprive the people smugglers of their product. And secure borders do just that.
Amnesty describes that position as untenable and is calling on Australia to shut down its offshore processing centres and allow legitimate refugees to enter Australia. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
It's earnings season and companies reporting their quarterly performances always moves financial markets. Moving our way with the latest is VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino from New York.
Well, we're seeing markets right now teeter between gains and losses, and this is amid mixed economic data and as investors prepare for their earnings onslaught over the next 4 weeks. Just in this week alone, we have nearly 100 companies reporting, which is about 20% of the S&P 500, of which 11 are Dow components. So there certainly is a lot on the table for traders to digest this week, although I do think it's a welcome change from being so laser-focused on the election and interest rate hike potential. So earnings this morning, they were mixed for the most part. Bank of America was the latest bank to report better results. Again, these are all on lowered expectations, but gains fade just like we saw last week with JP Morgan and Wells Fargo. Hasbro, the toy maker, had a blowaway quarter as well. Transports were higher on airline strength, but truckers with JB Hunt missing, that hurt the group a bit. And tonight we're going to look forward to earnings from Netflix and IBM. Netflix, one of the most widely traded and also one of the most widely misunderstood stocks, we'll be reporting after the close tomorrow morning, again dominated by financials with CMA, BlackRock, Goldman Sachs, and Regions. Healthcare, two big names reporting, Johnson & Johnson and United Health. I'm curious to see what United Health has to say around election rhetoric, because right now, outside of what's happening with Wells Fargo and bank sales, I think the other major sector to watch is going to be healthcare, particularly with price gouging, which has been a very hot topic. In fact, we have Bernie Sanders making the rounds on that as well. Macro picture, again, it's going to be quiet. We saw a small move in the bonds and gold. Oil slid back below that key $50 level. Beyond that, the markets are looking forward to the third and final debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump Wednesday night. Near term, once the election is over, we'll get some of that near-term volatility. Longer term, I think markets are going to do what they historically have done on election cycles, is essentially, you know, shrug it off and continue to do their own thing.
There's a lot of chatter about interest rates possibly going up in December.
Right. That's going to be the next thing that traders look to. The following FOMC meeting, it's on November 1st and 2nd, where we'll get that interest rate hike decision on the 2nd. It's virtually priced out of the market that it's not going to occur. Then I just think there's so much election risk, and the fact that we're in the thick of earnings that will hold Janet Yellen and her team from raising hikes. That said, the December FOMC meeting, there's about a 67% chance that we're going to get that rate hike. I think at this point, traders and investors are so exhausted by debating whether or not we're going to get a rate hike that it will almost be welcome, if that makes any sense. Of course, like any other major market moving event, we'll see that near-term volatility, and investors will wait to see how it consolidates following the rate hike decision. But I think right now, traders are happy to be focused on earnings and more fundamental areas in the market. We'll get through that election, we'll get through that December rate hike, and you know, traders and analysts I speak to think that we're set up pretty good for 2017.
We're always set up with great fundamentals when we speak with Jill Malandrino from New York. Jill, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
And be sure to follow all the latest at our website, voanews.com, on Twitter at VOA_IE, and we also have a Facebook page. It's VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Millions of people from around the world visit America's national parks every year to immerse themselves in spectacular land and waterscapes and have a chance to see a wide variety of wildlife in its natural habitat. Micah Meyer is on a mission to visit all of the more than 400 sites within the National Park Service. Julie Tabo narrates as VOA caught up with Meyer at Acadia National Park in the northeastern state of Maine.
This is Acadia National Park in the northeastern state of Maine. Known for its pristine waters, rugged landscapes, and historic carriage roads, which attract millions of visitors every year. Micah Meyer is just one of those lucky visitors.
What I think made Acadia unique was that you have these big mountains right next to the ocean. So that juxtaposition of the rocks and the waves and the mountains seemed to be kind of Acadia's signature.
The very first national park established east of the Mississippi River, Acadia is over 20,000 hectares of lush woodland, rocky beaches, and majestic granite mountains. Families from across the United States and around the world have come to Maine to enjoy the park and the many amazing animals that call it home for a century. Thanks to the generosity of a dedicated group of wealthy Americans who have helped protect and preserve these precious lands for everyone. Julie Pavlo, VOA News, Washington.
If you have a chance, go online and check out Julie Tabo's story. Amazing visuals there. Lots of video to watch from our wonderful national parks. Always great. And if you have a chance to stop by the United States at some point in your travels, be sure and check out some of the parks. Spectacular views. We thank you so much for listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, recently sanctioned two individuals, Gabriel Amisi Kumba and John Numbi, following increasing indications that the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, continues to suppress political opposition in the country, often through violent means. Specifically, on September 28th, the United States designated John Numbi for engaging in actions or policies that undermine democratic processes or institutions in the DRC, and Gabriel Amisi Kumba for being the leader of an armed group that has threatened the peace, security, or stability of the DRC. These steps reflect the United States' continued commitment to disrupt this destructive behavior and foster a better and more stable future for the DRC and the Congolese people. As a result of these actions, all of the designated individuals' assets within U.S. jurisdiction are frozen, and U.S. persons are generally prohibited from engaging in transactions with them. In announcing these designations, John Smith, acting OFAC director, stated, "These current and former Democratic Republic of the Congo government officials have engaged in actions that undermine democratic processes in the DRC and repress the political rights and freedoms of the Congolese people, risking further and more widespread instability in the DRC and the broader Great Lakes region. This action is not directed against the people of the DRC. It is intended to alter the behavior of the targeted individuals." DRC state agents have reportedly continued to violate the human rights and fundamental freedoms of people in the DRC, including through the use of excessive force in response to political demonstrations. Most recently, large-scale demonstrations in Kinshasa on September 19th and 20th, in response to delays in the announcement of elections, erupted into violent clashes, resulting in fatalities between demonstrators and security forces in Kinshasa and elsewhere in the country. There were reports of lethal use of force by DRC state agents in response to the recent demonstrations, as well as violent criminal acts committed by individuals in Kinshasa. The violence of September 19th and 20th underscores the need for an inclusive dialogue process on an electoral timetable to ensure a peaceful and democratic transfer of power. The United States continues to call on all stakeholders to refrain from violence. In this respect, we would stress that the government and its security forces have an obligation to respect and ensure human rights, and we would note that violence will hinder, not enhance, the prospects for an inclusive dialogue.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.